You can start?
Yeah, I'll start. Mm-hmm. Today is June 11th, 2019. I'm Eric Ligi with the Rao Jewish History Program and Archives, and this is the Bet Tikva Oral History Project. I'm speaking with Frank Wilson at his home in Chandler, Arizona. So, Frank, if you could start by telling me a little bit about where you grew up and what it was like.
Sure. I grew up in central Pennsylvania, small town Carlisle. Carlisle is most noted for the Dickinson Law School and also the U.S. Army War College. And at one time, the Washington Redskins did their summer practice in Carlisle. It's a town of approximately 15,000, or at least it was at that time. So things were constantly bustling. You know, like most small towns back in the 50s and 60s, there were like lots of businesses like in the downtown area. You know, malls were probably just something that were coming on the scene. I grew up Catholic, attending both grade school and high school. So there was like, I had lots of religious training. However, I don't recall that within the teachings and catechisms of the church that they were not as ecumenical in talking about other religions. It was, you know, solely focused on the Catholic faith. There, in Carlisle, best of my knowledge, there was one identified Jewish person, and he was married to a non-Jewish person, Mr. Goldstein. And I was a little bit confused because sometimes you, during the holidays, you could go by their house and there would be like a wreath on the door. So, but anyway, so I, you know, again, going through high school, when I graduated from high school, I knew there was a world to be discovered and explored, and I decided to make that journey. Also, there was one clue growing up that I recall that made me feel like I was Jewish, and it was the cover of a Life magazine back in approximately 60-61 that I had observed. And you know, normally I would just kind of like page through, you know, the magazine, but I had to read this article about Sammy Davis Jr. And after reading that, you know, there was this, I don't know, I truly identified with what he himself had done in terms of his conversion. So anyway, I left Carlisle in 69 to attend college in Pittsburgh. It was Robert Morris College at the time. And I met all kinds of people. Robert Morris at that time sponsored... they must have had a, like an affiliation with Gulf Oil, because then Gulf Oil sponsored people from Kuwait, Iran, Saudi Arabia. So it's sort of interesting meeting, like, you know, those individuals. And, you know, I met people of the Jewish faith. And so... so, when, you know, eventually one of my roommates, Don... who was from Cleveland, Ohio. He attended Park Synagogue, had his bar mitzvah there. He was very proud of his bar mitzvah and Park Synagogue. He, you know, at one time, you know, I went to Cleveland with him, and he was just very excited about showing me the temple. And this is the old Park Synagogue, because I think now there's like a newer facility somewhere in the suburbs, further out in the suburbs. But anyway, The first synagogue service that I ever attended was in Swickley. I don't recall the name of the synagogue. I want to say Ohav Shalom, but I don't even know if it's in existence any longer. But Don asked me if I would like to go, and I said, oh, absolutely. And, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect, you know, in terms of the service. But anyway, after the service, and I think it was like more on the Reform side, after the service, one of the members invited all of us to, you know, his home, for, I don't know, I guess you could call it like an oneg of sorts. And I thought that was, it was exciting. It was, you know, I was very full of gratitude, number one, that you know, members of the Jewish community at the school had wanted me to, you know, attend along with them. So, you know, I really enjoyed, like, the hospitality that the family had shown. And so, you know, time moved on. You know, we all kind of like went our separate ways, still keeping in touch with, you know, a few folks. One of them happened to be my friend Don, an old time roommate. So somewhere between 72 and 76, 1976, explored a little bit more in terms of learning about the Jewish faith by reading. At one point, let me backtrack here. I moved to East Liberty when I got my first, you know, job at Mellon Bank. It was Penn and Nagley, Penn Plaza Apartments. And I noticed, you know, that there were mezuzahs on a lot of the doors. I started reading on my own. At one point, I made the decision to go to a synagogue. Now, you know, I used to explore the neighborhood quite a bit. So I knew that, you know, the B'nai Israel congregation was right there on Nagley Avenue. If you walk down Nagley towards Highland Park, it was obviously, you know, Jewish. One day, and I think it was like one of the high holiday services, and I stood in front of the synagogue, and someone had dropped their kippah on the ground, and to me that was like a sign that I needed to, if I were to go somewhere, it was going to be B'nai Israel. Just the facade of B'nai Israel was amazing to me. The workmanship, you know, the architecture, and I found out later that the same architect, Hornbostel, I think his name is, also did the design for Road of Shalom in Oakland. And so anyway, I started attending services there at B'nai Israel. Rabbi Jack Schechter was there as the, you know, rabbi. He wasn't, let's just say, he wasn't very welcoming. And, you know, that's the vibe that I got. But I still attended services. And I started reading the Pittsburgh Jewish Chronicle. And I read one time that they were having adult learning services, and one of the classes happened to be Hebrew. So I called the synagogue to make a reservation, and a woman by the name of Rose Berman answered the phone. And I said, oh, by the way, I said, you know, I'm not Jewish. And she says, well, that doesn't matter. And so she, you know, put my name down on the list to for the Beginner's Hebrew 101. So I walked into the classroom, and Reverend Hallman, Cantor Hallman, you know, however you want to identify him, was there. And for anyone who knew Reverend Hallman, larger-than-life character, you know, deep voice. And his words to me were that, I hope you're not here to convert. And I said, oh, no, 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 no. So I successfully completed, you know, his Hebrew 101 class. And this, again, time-wise, it was probably like around 1976, 77. So anyway, Rabbi Schechter decided he, you know, was going to transfer to California, a shul there in California. And the incoming rabbi came, you know, to do his service to introduce himself to the congregation. And so I attended that service. And after listening to his sermon, he was like going to be the one, if I was going to fully go through the conversion process, Rabbi Markovitz was going to be the one to see that that was fulfilled for me. So,
what was it about him?
His sermon, his delivery, how he explained, you know, the Torah portion for that day. I don't know, there was just something unique and different about him. And, you know, I thought, you know, if anyone, because I also attended services prior, like one or two at Rodef Shalom with Rabbi Walter Jacob was the rabbi there at the time. I didn't want a Reform conversion, but I didn't want an Orthodox conversion. And I thought, well, that's, you know, go in between. And not that that means anything, but to me, it did. Rabbi Markovitz then, you know, had given me like a list of books to read, you know, and whatnot. And, you know, then at one point around 1977, 78, we had, you know, went to the mikveh, and I had a ritual circumcision by an Orthodox moyel, Rabbi Benjamin Nadoff, of blessed memory, because I heard that he's no longer here with us. Reverend Hallman was there, as what was Rabbi Markovitz, and Rabbi, I don't recall his name, but he was the rabbi prior to Rabbi Jamie at Temple Sinai.
Was it Ilson? Aaron Ilson?
No, and then maybe before that. So,
what was it about Judaism that was attractive to you?
Well, I evolved, into Judaism. You know, first it was, you know, and let's go back here, you know, rooming with my Jewish roommate, Don, you know, he would bring foods that were part of the holiday, you know, so if it, you know, Passover, he would bring in matzah and chopped liver, which I never had, and it's like a felt of fish, oh, Frank, you have to try this, and da-da-da-da. So, you know, that was my first sort of introduction into the culture. And later, you know, it was like, you know, it was the study, the reading and the study of Judaism. And something just drew me, and I really can't pinpoint exactly what it is, but I was certainly captivated by whatever it is that drew me there. So, again, got into to the mikveh, did the ritual circumcision. Not too long after that, Rabbi Markowitz, or this, you know, the congregation had sponsored a trip to Israel, which I you know, had taken back in 78. And that was, you know, it was actually my first foreign trip, at least over the Atlantic. But I'm still trying to think, pinpoint exactly what it is, but I think it's a conglomerate of things. It, you know, it was the religion itself, you know, the practice. I was intrigued by how, especially Orthodoxy, how like how they abided by the rules, the commandments, and not that I wanted that for myself. Now I need to give a disclaimer here, I guess you could call it that. Besides being a male, I'm also a black male, and I'm also a black gay male who's now open. But I was trying to reconcile my orientation with this newfound religion. Somehow or another, I, you know, managed to do that. You know, the black part, you know, that was easy, you know, because, you know, I kind of pretty much knew what to expect, you know, from a lot of, you know, maybe some older Jewish people. But, you know, I think eventually, you know, even with them, I at some point gained their respect. So anyway,
were there ever complications?
Such as, I mean, like social complications?
Cool. Yeah, moments when just there were tension or you felt uncomfortable.
No. And if you're talking like socially, no, because I'm pretty good at that. Yeah. I mean, I can walk into a room of Fulbright scholars and feel just you know, at home with them. So anyway, you know, did the trip to Israel. You know, I came back. I had decided to wait a year to have my first calling up to the Torah, only because I wanted my family to be there, you know, which they came the following April. And so it was good having them there. So I was a full-fledged member of B'nai Israel from 1978-79 through the closing, which was in 1995. At some point, I met an individual. I was working at St. Francis Hospital, and he was a patient there. So we were talking, and he gave me his number and said, to if I chose to, I could call him. We could go out maybe some afternoon for tea and crumpets. So I held off for a couple of weeks, and I thought better, and it's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to, his name was Richard. I'm going to give Richard a call. And if I didn't say that Richard was, if I didn't identify him as being Jewish, yes, he was Jewish and he was gay. And white. And so, I called Richard and, we, enjoyed, each other's company. We became good friends. He had a partner who he was, living with. But we decided to attend the gay congregation here in Pittsburgh, Bet Tikva. So Richard, called to get some information. And services were being held the first Friday, I think, of every month. So we went, and, if I recall, there were only maybe about, four other people there, along with a woman who was sort of spearheading the congregation.
About what time is this?
What year?
Yeah.
So this would have been, 1986. Yeah, because I met Richard October of 86, and it wasn't too long after that that we...
So the earliest information we've been able to find is from April of 88.
Okay. So, but again, I met Richard in October of 86. And I don't think that 2 years would have elapsed between, but maybe, maybe that's possible.
Where was it being held?
At Road of Shalom.
Okay.
Right. And so, when you say, information, are you talking about, notes? I mean, I'm not sure what, the time between 86 and 88, there seems to be a gray area for you.
The earliest note that we've been able to find is a listing in Out
mm-hmm.
from April of 88. And then Abram had said that maybe for a few months before that people were meeting at his house. So that would go back to, the fall of 87.
Okay. I don't recall that. That Richard and I had gone to someone's home. So maybe it was 2 years. It just didn't, it didn't seem like it was, that long. I don't remember attending services at anyone's house in particular.
What were your impressions of the first service that you went to?
It was small. It was intimate. The numbers obviously were not great. I think it was my first time in the chapel of Rosh Shalom. Shirley, who was sort of the coordinator, she didn't go by numbers. if people came, they came. If not, but you know, I think Shirley did a good job for the time, short time that we had known her. Shirley had passed on within a year's time of Richard and I attending Bet Tikva. So my affiliation then with Bet Tikva was probably then closer to 88. But now I'm late, you know, there's like this lapse of time for me. It's like, Richard, though, we had an interest in going to other shuls. And, you know, so we would attend services at, I recall, Polo Zedek once, we went to like a host of other places, Rabbi Stanley, in the downtown area. Yeah, we went there. Richard was not deeply religious, but religious, if that makes any sense. I remember one time Richard and I had taken a trip to San Francisco to visit his sister, who was hosting a Passover Seder dinner. So, you know, we took the time to explore, because it was my first time in San Francisco. But we went to some basilica there. And, you know, I think the Pope, would have been Pope John, had been there like maybe a few months prior or a year prior. But Richard, he enjoyed the moment of getting holy water and blessing himself. Anywho,
did you start going regularly to Bet Tikva after that?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You mean like after their first meeting?
Yeah.
Yes, we did. You know, and I also, you know, should again go back again to my friend and old roommate Don, who's, you know, gay as well. None of us knew we were gay in school, and, you know, kind of like found out like a whole lot of things like, and only if we had known, kind of thing. So, Don had moved all over the place. You know, first went back to Cleveland, and then he had moved to a province town, Cape Cod, moved back to Cleveland, and then eventually wound up in Dallas. Don was the founding member of the Jewish congregation Beth El Bana, which had, you know, from the time it began small until it had grown so big that they actually became they probably became like a charter. I'm sure of that. Don, you know, unfortunately, had passed away in 1992. After Shirley's death, there were a few of us who were determined to get things going again, increase the numbers, we did so through various events. We were at one point eventually listed in the Pittsburgh Jewish Chronicle, And there was a contact number there posted, which happened to be me, by the way. And people did call and express like an interest. So we made sure that we were out there so that people knew that that we did exist. We participated in the pride parades, marched very proudly with Jews down Liberty Avenue with our banner and flag. We also had other activities, that we were involved with, and trips. I think the biggest trip was one weekend we had gone to the Holocaust Museum, that Friday night we went to services in Washington D.C. at the gay congregation there, whose name I don't recall. But they also seemed to be, a together congregation. They had things going on. But, it's Washington, D.C. Our trip to the Holocaust Museum was very good. Someone who works there, volunteers there, who knew that we were coming, gave a talk on the treatment of homosexuals during the Holocaust era. If I can, I want to backtrack to B'nai Israel. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. While at B'nai Israel, I was very much involved. I was a member of the men's club. I was also one of the ushers, and which I really enjoyed that job. And I was a regular there on Shabbat mornings, and also from Mincha Marv and Havdalah service, and there were a certain group of older people who attended regularly the Mincha Marv, and Havdalah, but there would be like the meal that's like served, and Mrs. Herman Feldman, I think her name, first name was B. Feldman, made the most scrumptious cakes and salads that she would like bring, And I was also telling Eric, about my involvement with the sisterhood when they had like their donor shows. They would put on this big entertainment show, and the room, the social room, would just be filled to capacity. With members, so it was like one of the big things at B'nai Israel. Besides other things, I also would help decorate the sukkah, which the sisterhood took responsibility for. And when I could, if the holidays fell like on a Monday and Tuesday or something, then I would try to get off for Sukkot, but sometimes I couldn't. So I would maybe go the evening before. I was pretty, very much involved in what happened at B'nai in the time that I was at B'nai Israel. I became very familiar with the service. To the point that at one time I made the decision to go to the former Soviet Union, which I told you the other day. And we happened to be in the Ukraine, and there must have been like 15 other people in the tour group who were Jewish. So we went to Babi Yar, and, you know, we held hands in a circle, and long and short of it was, you know, that I, the convert, was the only one in the group who could recite Kaddish, Mourner's Kaddish. And so, you know, they were very, what's the word, elated that, number one, that someone was able to do that, because, you know, a couple of them had family members who had perished. And so, so yeah. So my experience at B'nai Israel transferred over then, I think, to Bet Tikva, where I, in those early years, along with the other folks, you know, services became a little bit more organized. I was also the shofar person. There's a name for it, which I don't recall. But I was the one who was able to blow the shofar for the holidays. And that came about just out of nowhere. You know, I always wanted to have in my possession a shofar. And so I was kind of like self-taught. And I used to go over to Greenfield, to the cemetery there. I don't know if it's Greenfield, but there was a cemetery that kind of looks down in the valley. And practice. So, as Bet Tikva grew, you know, there were more relationships that came about, friendships. And, you know, we became one big family. And we would actually travel to other congregations for Friday night services in the area. I think one time we visited Butler, Pennsylvania. And again, I don't recall the name of the shul there. And we also had gone to Temple Emmanuel in South Hills, you know, for service. And they were very, you know, very welcoming. They knew, you know, these congregations knew that we were coming. So, you know, they were there with open arms. I was with Bet Tikva then from approximately 1988 through 1998, because it was 98 that my partner and I had moved here to Arizona. I don't know, what are the questions about what
else? The service like at Bet Tikva?
The service itself? We sort of like had our own way of doing service. You know, it was both in English, you know, and you know, the other prayers were in Hebrew, you know, the more important prayers, but mostly in English. At some point we were able to get folks to give a drash on any particular topic that they wanted to, you know, talk about. Because I think, you know, Val and or Deb, I recall, had given some very good ones. And there were some other members who were able to do that very well. Membership at Bet Tikva, you know, was sort of like, you know, there would be professionals, you know, maybe who were at UPMC, what was Presbyterian at the time. You know, they were sort of like you know, they were in town for a hot minute because of their jobs, and, you know, then they were gone. So then there would just be, like, this new, like, new members would come in then. And, but there was also, like, then, like, that steady core of individuals who were there permanently. And, you know, we made sure that, you know, things, you know, got done. I'll never forget the first sukkah that we had built at the congregation. And it was beautiful, if I have to say so myself.
Where was it?
It was at the home of Bruce. Bruce, can I say his name? Last name? Yeah, he's pretty open. Yeah, he's very open. Bruce Hyde. In Squirrel Hill, and we had, you know, we had a service indoors, yeah, in his house, and then, you know, went to the sukkah. But anyway, it just turned out beautiful. Bruce was married at one time, so, you know, his son did not come for the service, but came a day or two later. And I think he was probably around 13 years of age, 14. He was a, I guess you could say he was like a yeshiva booker. You know, he's pretty much like, you know, and I think he struggled with his dad, you know, being gay, but I think Bruce went up his way to, you know, trying to get him to understand things, understand life. But but the son, again, I don't remember his name, I had provided, like, holiday lights, Christmas lights, to be strung up. And his son was a little bit discouraged, but you have Christmas lights, so, and, you know, Bruce tried to explain to him, they're just lights, you know, the fact that they came out of, you know, a box that said Christmas Twinkle or something, it was irrelevant, you know, it was just, you know, it was, they were lights, and, you know. Now that I'm thinking about it, you know, they were almost like the colors of the pride flag. So there was, you know, it was meant to be that we had Christmas lights in our first sukkah.
Was everything in the service done by the congregants?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think there was one time we had a guest speaker from, I don't exactly recall, but someone outside of the congregation, and I don't exactly recall what that person, it was a man, but I don't recall. We had organized to the point where once we attended a baseball game at Three Rivers, and so there must have been like 15 of us who had gone, but you know, our name came up on the Jumbotron, you know, and so we were all excited. And we did all the pride flags, and so, yeah, I mean, and I'm trying to recall if we did, like, outreach in some way. And, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, I think we could have been better at that, at doing outreach either to the community, the gay community, because at that time, people, you know, individuals were still dying at an alarming rate from AIDS or AIDS-related illnesses. So I think you know, in terms of the report card or scorecard, I'll give us, you know, like an A in terms of organization. But I think, you know, in terms of like outreach, it's probably more like a D.
A D. So this big growth was just entirely from people responding to the ad in the Chronicle?
Yeah, largely, yeah. Yeah. And then we would also have like our annual Passover Seder the second night. At first we were having it at the Irene Kaufman camp. Is that
Monroeville?
Yeah, Monroeville. Yeah. So when we decided to do it, that's where it was held. I think now they have it at a different location, and it may even be catered. We try to be as much of a religious congregation and a social gathering. And you know, it's like you suggested earlier, it's a place we could all go and be comfortable. Speaking for myself, I was comfortable in any situation, religious, Jewish, you know, wise, whether it was Orthodox, Reformed, or Conservative.
How did the wider Jewish community treat you as a group?
No, I don't have. I really don't have like an answer to that because I. Maybe one person did voice their opinion, I don't know if it was something that was verbal or maybe it was something as a. On the editorial page of the Jewish Chronicle, what do you call that? Like a
letters to the editor.
Yeah, letters to the editor. Like why does there need to be a gay congregation? And you know, this person went on. It wasn't anything that was demeaning, but then you know, the person was just voicing their opinion. A lot of the congregations are now joining, joining other mainstream congregations. The gay congregation here in the Phoenix area dissolved this past year. So they did not become part of any other Reformed congregation that I'm aware of. What's good, I was just as comfortable at B'nai Israel. And you have to understand, like at that time, there was like a turning point within the conservative movement. Anyway, when I first joined B'nai Israel, women were not counted in the minyan, and so they did not become egalitarian until sometime like later. And other changes like female rabbis. Interesting. I knew another woman, young woman, who around the same time that I converted to Judaism, her name was Nancy, she was a nurse, had served in Vietnam, and she. Like myself, was drawn to Judaism for one reason or another. Nancy had moved to Israel maybe a couple of years afterwards, lived there for a short time. When she came back, she applied, to the theological seminary in New York City. I had gone up to see her one weekend, and I actually stayed at the seminary. So it was kind of neat. They rent out rooms during the summer months, I think.
What was the liturgy at Tikva?
Well, I mean, it was more on the Reform side, but the liturgy.
Just what did it look like and what did it consist of?
Well, again, we try to make the liturgy look as close as possible to what another congregation would do. So we would start off, with the Shema, and, work our way up to, Kaddish at the end.
Were you using a prayer book?
No. I mean, I gave you a copy of the High Holiday prayer book that we had, but no. I think we had like just sheets that we would pass out with, so it wasn't really like a prayer book. I mean, we're not using Word of Shalom's prayer book. So, it was pretty much like whoever volunteered to do the service any particular week, that person had carte blanche to do whatever they wanted to do.
Did you ever leave?
Oh, yeah.
So what did you do when you left?
Good question. Well, because my background, my Jewish background was on the conservative, and I tried to, go that direction in terms of like the Musaf service, because I, didn't always have, again, we had sheets, with prayers, that you could select. Let's put it that way. So the liturgy itself wasn't the same every first Friday of the month. It all depended upon who was like leading the service, and one service that stands out is the first Yom Kippur Eve service, Kol Nidre, and we actually had someone who acted as cantor who was on who was in the B'nai Israel choir, and she had a very good friend who died of AIDS. So she had this familiarity with the gay community, and so she had volunteered, and it's real special. I have pictures, but I don't know where they are. I had made a memorial board with the names of the people who had passed on, like in the congregation. And
was it printed?
No. It was like a wooden board. I had another member to drill holes in, and so I put, you know, like, lights in, and their names were on paper. According to Alan, you know, it was still in use, up till fairly recently.
So it was sort of a yard-side plaque for Bet Tikva.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it just, you know, if you walked into the home of Eric and his partner, like, you know, seeing, like, the you know, the board, like, lit up with the menorah lit up. And it was just, yeah. Because I'll never forget the first time at B'nai Israel, when I walked in for Kol Nidre. And it was the first time, you know, I had seen, like, all the yard side plaques, like, lit up. I was just, this is so beautiful. I can't explain just how fulfilling that was. And I mean, it was a very touching, emotional moment. But I think the reason behind it is that you remember, like, the people that have passed on. And, you know, I find that fascinating. And when time comes, I would like someone to, you know, remember, memorialize me. And I'm sure there will be someone who would do it. And it really doesn't matter where, but just as long as it's somewhere. So that on, you know, those days, I'm remembered, like, in some way, I think. Yeah.
You had other things that you made that were sort of, for lack of a better word, ritual objects. And the one in the photograph that you were showing me was the Ark, the Torah Ark.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind describing that?
I'm a very creative person, as a lot of people who know me, you know, they know that about me. I'm the kind of person who can walk into a Goodwill store and see, or a garage sale or a junkyard, and see something beyond what it is, and it can be used for something, you know. And it's a gift. It truly is, because most people don't have, like, that gift. And so I have other pictures. We used to have services at the church there on Belfield. I don't recall the name of it. The tower is still there, right across from the Cathedral of Learning, or catty corner to it. So what I did one year, I used a baker's rack and lifted up the shelves, or some of the middle shelves, and went from there. I had designed an arc curtain of sorts, it was probably, I forgot the dimensions on it, but it's, you know, fairly good size. And somehow or another, and again, I borrowed the Torah cover from Rhoda, and, you know, and you know, made it into an ark. And then the picture that you're referring to was a, I guess, like a China front or something. I'm not sure what you would call that. But I also had, like, these finials, Torah finials, or Ramonim that I would, you know, put it, had made and put it inside. Folks knew that they were, you know, there was they were going to see something very visual, and it had Frank's imprint, it had my imprint all over it. People say that about me now. They'll say, "Oh, yeah, you know, Frank's touch." You know, they know my touch. but I was very passionate about that. A lot of time, a lot of work. My partner Brian, who was a in Pittsburgh, he taught at CCAC over on the north side, so he primarily had evening classes. So there was like lots of time to do things, and that's when I would, you know, make the banners or whatever. But I enjoyed it. You know, it was still like that connection to the Jewish community in some way.
That tikva or the creative projects?
The creative projects. Yeah. And even after we arrived here, the first thing I did was I called the Phoenix Jewish News to subscribe to the paper. That was the first thing, believe it or not. And I think, you know, most people would find other things to do first. You know, well, if you have children, well, you know, you find out the schools or whatever. But for me, it was, I'm still going to be connected, you know, even if it's just getting the weekly Jewish news. And then I met two other individuals after arriving here. When we came here to Arizona, I left my job at St. Francis, came to Arizona, didn't know what I was going to do. My partner, Brian, had just earned his doctorate, so he was set up with Maricopa County Community College system as a associate dean at the time. So I then became a flight attendant, something I wanted to do early on, and I thought, well, this would be the opportunity. I saw an ad, you know, went for an interview, and you know, met another gay Jewish male flight attendant. So we decided to go to I think it was Yom Kippur services at Temple Chai, you know. And so we went. But then when we left there, we knew that the gay congregation here they were having like a break the fast thing, and so we kind of like went to that, but no one really like reached their arms out to us, you know. And then I met a woman who was running the Judaic, can't get it out. She had a store that sold Jewish items. It was a tongue twister. But anyway, conversing with her. She has her in Chandler. And found out that we both had worked for an airline as flight attendants. She worked for Southwest, and I was with America West. So we had a good conversation, and she was saying that the rabbi at one of the Reformed temples here in Chandler um, uh, came out and is now like he was a flight attendant at Southwest as well. Actually, the rabbi they have now is gay, and he and his partner, and they have like I think two children. And I think that's wonderful. I think it speaks to the times, and situations like that were like pretty much like unheard of, maybe even like 10 years ago, and it's unfortunate because then it forces people into these bubbles, and it causes like confusion and. Can I be welcome both as a gay man and as a Jew, and all kinds of issues come up, and I think the reform movement has done really well in trying to be accepting and open. A lot of the mainstream, some mainstream conservative congregations have moved forward, like in that respect. I'm not sure where they are as far as like gay marriage, but I think you could be like a gay rabbi, openly gay rabbi in the conservative movement. Orthodox, enough said. That's not to say that there aren't gay people within the Orthodox movement. One year we were having our Seder at the camp, Kaufman camp, and out of the clear blue this guy pops in, and he had all the Orthodox garb, and he appeared to be, he was a person of color, to say that. I don't know exactly what his ethnicity truly was, but he was in Pittsburgh and he wanted to attend a Seder, a gay Seder, and he made it known that he was gay, and so that was sort of interesting. For some reason he gave me his phone number. I called him. The conversation just wasn't going where I wanted the conversation to go. So it's like, I didn't make any attempt at, getting the particulars of this individual, although I would really love to have known how he reconciles being an Orthodox. I mean, and we're talking, Orthodox, like those people like in Upper State New York. What do you call them?
Hasidim?
Yeah, Hasidim. Yeah. So he was at that level. He wasn't more modern Orthodox. He was way above that.
Were there any conversations at Bet Tikva about affiliating with a larger congregation or merging or joining like the Reform movement or having a rabbi, anything like that, that would have been something that like a larger congregation would do?
Yes, those conversations did occur, but after I left.
Okay, so they weren't happening while you were there at all?
No.
Okay.
No.
There's a 3-year window. If B'nai Israel closes in 95 and you leave in 98, during those 3 years, were you going somewhere else for the 3 out of the 4 weeks of the month that Bet Tikva didn't have services?
No. You mean like Beth Shalom or New Later?
Or just anything. Like, was Bet Tikva your sole shul at that for those 3 years?
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of membership. But that's not to say that Richard and I did not go to some other...
Just exploring.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else about Bet Tikva that you can think of?
Not really. It was. I think Bet Tikva kept me sane. because I knew there was like a safe haven to go to as a gay person, and I could still, yeah, and I can't, I still do embrace, you know, Judaism on one side from a conservative point of view, but I also embrace, you know, my gayness and the gay, you know, the gay congregation, Bet Tikva. And so again, no, it's nothing, you know, it was just a good experience, you know, with the trips. And then, like, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, a couple of the congregations, like the one in Butler, one in South Hills, you know, who knew that we were coming, they didn't have a problem with it. And so that you know, shed some light on that things are getting better. Because even, you know, with politics being the way that it is today, it seems like we're taking a step backward in a lot of areas, whether it's race, religion, and almost to the point, well, are we going to be going back to the 50s and the 60s? You know, you have to be a closeted gay person, you know, because we've made so many strides, you know, in the past decade. I hope it doesn't come to that, but, you know, and I hate to say what I'm about to say, but, you know, with politics being the way that it is, and if it continues, you know, into the next few, you know, years, you know, I envision, and I know it's not going to happen, but I just see, like, particular groups being purged. And if not, you know, not necessarily purge, but, you know, put back into the closet, so to speak. You know, and again, you know, it's just not, you know, gay rights, it's voting rights, it's equality, all around. You know, where there, you know, people who have been marginalized, they're going to become marginalized again, and if things get bad, I'm not saying, you know, that, and when I say purge, I'm not saying that they're going to force people to go to, you know, death camps or, you know, whatnot, but it'll be like, you know, I don't think, you know, it'll be like kind of like a death camp, because you'll be forced back into the closet, in, you know, in terms of being gay. So yeah, that's, you know, I miss Bet Tikva, I miss the people, I miss you know, going to services first Friday every month. I miss, you know, decorating the sukkah. However, 3 years before Brian passed away, I was determined to have my own sukkah. And I went to Home Depot, and I got lumber, and I got bamboo wraparound and whatnot, and it was hot, you know. But Brian, you know, he would do the frame and the whole thing, and so you know, everything had to be done within like two or three days. So when it was all said and done, and I had, you know, decorated palm branches on the top of it, Brian was just this, he was like, this is beautiful. This, you know, I mean, he was like beside himself, you know, so how, you know, like that number was transferred into that. I mean, he knew what a sukkah was because Beth Shalom always had like their sukkah like on the front porch of the shul, you know. So, you know, he you know would ask, you know, like, well, why is it there? You know, what is that? So I would explain to him. And but I always wanted a sukkah, and you know, my wish came true, and yeah. So that's my story, folks. it was a long journey, you know, from someone, again, from someone who came from a town, you know, or an environment that you know, Judaism was not really the topic of conversation. You know, I really didn't know about anything about the Holocaust until much later in life. I'm talking much later. I mean, like in my 20s. But then, you know, I really didn't know about the internment of Japanese folks either.
Yeah.
I knew the Native American story because Carlisle used to be one of the places where they would send Native Americans for... And in fact, if you walk into the Heard Museum, as soon as you, like, walk in the door, there's a map and photo of Carlisle where the Indian school used to be.
Yeah.
Yes. So that was kind of... I mean, I wasn't expecting that, but yeah. So, yeah, I hope the political climate changes a little bit and that we're not going backwards. But you never know. I think, you know, I don't have any regrets about, you know, leaving Christianity. I'm, you know, now challenged with, you know, with should I or should I not say anything when I, you know, feel like I the need to challenge people on certain issues, especially within the Catholic Church. Especially with the Catholics, you know, and it's like, Frank, don't go there, don't go there, but sometimes I do, and and so, as I mentioned to you, you know, or maybe, I don't know if I did, but like, not this past Easter, but maybe the Easter before, I got invited to someone's home, and I brought up the, you know, the subject that Jesus probably was married and had children. It didn't go over quite well at the dinner table. But you know what? I'm good for that. You know, and it's not only like, you know, religion. You know, this home that I go to for holidays. You know, I'm usually like the one who begins the conversation. Everyone else is just like. Like, it's quiet, everyone's just like eating their meal, and it's, you know, and I will bring up something, a subject, and it just, it takes off from there. And so yeah, I probably would be a good facilitator in some manner, but you know, I haven't worked for a while.
Should we end there?
Yeah.
Okay.